Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday, the 30th of November, and this is Reconstruction with David Taylor and Phil Bishop from the Construction Index. We'll be discussing some of the news that we've covered in the past couple of weeks and indeed anything else that's caught our eye. So go on, Phil, you're the news guy. What's been happening?
Blimey. There's some football and there's some cricket starting tomorrow, all being well, if we can find 11 people who aren't throwing up. That's today's news. But in the wonderful world of construction, well, the big event since we last spoke actually seems like a very long time ago now, because it was just a day after we last spoke on the 17th of November was the autumn statement. And so I suppose we ought to do a bit of a recap on that, but other things might emanate from our discussion surrounding that. What did you think? I mean, I assume you read or listened to what the Chancellor had to say. Did you anything leap out at you?
Well, I mean, the one thing which I'm sure most other people interested in construction would have noticed is that he was quite emphatic about not making any cuts to capital spending. So that means that these big infrastructure projects that we've all been anticipating are still going to get the funding that has been promised. And although I think people are going to be expected to make economies where they can, because, of course, inflation is going to increase costs. But, so things like East-West Rail, that's the new line between Oxford and Cambridge, and Northern Powerhouse Rail, which is that, which also, I mean, that's very much in the news this week, that rail services up in the north are not what they should be. And, of course, HS2 and Sizewell C. Sizewell C was an interesting one. I think we'll talk about that in greater detail. So these big projects are all going to go ahead. They're all going to continue as planned, which I was rather surprised to hear, because I thought that at least there would be some scaling back. I wasn't really expecting any of them to be scrapped necessarily, but I was expecting some cuts, but apparently there aren't going to be any. I mean, did that surprise you?
You say there aren't going to be any cuts. Up to a point, Lord Copper, I think is the expression. The fact that we have got, 10% plus construction cost inflation, 20% in places, means that in real terms, they are being cut. The actual capital budgets are going up to 114 billion next year, 115 billion the year after. So an increase from 114 to 115 from next year to the year after, in the context of the inflation we've got at the moment. Now, inflation may come down a bit, but it's not going to disappear.
It's less than 1%.
Things will be tight. And two things come to mind. He doesn't want... Jeremy Hunt, Chancellor, neither wants nor needs to be the man or the politician to announce anything being cut or stopped, because we're likely to have a change of government in a couple of years' time, all the polls suggest. And, it'll be someone else's problem. Bit like when the Cameron Clegg coalition came in 2010 and there was a note in the Treasury saying, sorry, there's no more money left, we've spent it all.
Yes, that's right.
It's going to be a little note like that, I think, left for the next lot. So there will be cuts. But rather than saying we're not going to... we've had this conversation before, you and I, David, and I always say, so they're not going to say we're not going to do it. They're just going to drag their feet a bit to avoid spending the money quite so quickly. I mean, HS2 is always talked about as a £100 billion project, and how many hospitals and how many teachers could we pay for, and how many, local bus services could we fund, et cetera, et cetera, for £100 billion. But it's not £100 billion as a one-off payment. It's £100 billion over something like 20 years. And it'll probably end up being £100 billion over about 30 years. But, once it all delays, it all gets dragged out. I might be exaggerating a little bit. But it's not a £100 billion project, really. It's about a sort of a £5 billion a year project, which makes it sound rather different.
I mean, yes.
It makes it, it comes into the, you know, HS2 is about as much as we spend on filling potholes.
Yeah, that's probably not a very good good example. But yeah, sorry. No, that's an interesting way of looking at it because, yes, it's an ongoing cost, isn't it? And none of these projects have had... I suppose what you can say is the projects haven't been curtailed in terms of their scope. They haven't got as much money to play with, I suppose, is what it boils down to.
Yes, but all it takes is a little bit of foot dragging somewhere to push a start date back a year, and you've saved some money. Okay, in the long term, it makes it more expensive.
Yeah,
it's always more cost effective and cheaper to get things done quickly on the whole. Although, what's that saying? You can either have something done well, cheap, or quickly, but you can't have all three. You've always got to sacrifice one of those. That's what I tell anyone who commissions an article from me. Do you want it good? Do you want it quick? Or do you want it cheap? Pick two out of three.
Yeah. Well, okay. So, I mean, I think that was quite interesting. I mean, the fact that we are going to see these big projects, you know, they haven't been axed. And so I suppose in a way it does kick the can down the road a little bit, doesn't it? And as you say, it could be somebody else's problem in a couple of years' time.
But we've already seen where there are going to be cuts. I mean, following on from that, unrelated but on the topic of which we are talking, there was a National Audit Office report out last week into the Department for Transport and National Highways road spending. Mm-hmm. And it's looking at what's called the second road investment strategy period, or RIS2, which is April 2020 to March 2025, is its five-year spending term for which National Highways is given an allocation by the Department for Transport. Mm-hmm. And that obviously has coincided with COVID. It's coincided with inflation and energy prices going up, and as every government press release now mentions, it's all Putin's fault. Well, of course, it's, you know, he's not helped things, and a lot of it is his fault. But there are other issues as well. But it's been a pretty tricky year for anyone who's given a you know, budgets at the beginning of 2020 to spend between April 2020 and March 2025. Will have struggled with the money that they were given to buy what they thought they were going to be able to buy, and that's what's happened to National Highways.
Yeah.
The costs have gone up by 3.3 billion net. The projects have overrun on the budget. What was the budget going to be? 27.4 was the budget for the period, and they've overrun that.
Yes.
So far they've overrun that by 3.3 billion, which is seem worse. But it's not particularly tidy. But what it does mean is that projects which were expected to start in this RIS2 period, you know, before March 2025, will be kicked into the next 5-year period.
Yeah.
It's not that necessarily projects are cancelled. It's just, we talked before, things being kicked down the road
They've
a
been
bit.
Postponed. Yeah.
But things may be cancelled. There's an interesting comment from the MP for Thurrock, who's a Conservative MP, who actually did rather well at the last election. See if I can find her name here. Jackie Doyle Price. She had quite a comfortable, in the 2019 sort of post-Brexit, although Thurrock is in the southeast, it's in Essex, it has sort of red wall characteristics as a constituency. It's sort of, you know, blue collar Essex. And it's in 2019, on the back of Brexit and Boris Johnson coming in, like we saw many of the red wall seats going blue, her majority went from what had been the previous 2, 3, 4 elections, almost recount territory. I mean, I can't remember exactly what, but sort of, you know, a couple of hundred kind of just slipping into a majority. This Tilbury MP actually had a huge majority, comfortable majority last time round, but it's traditionally a marginal seat, and it will be again at the next election. So she is very active as a good constituency MP, is very actively fighting for her constituency interests, and she is shouting against the Lower Thames Crossing. And the Lower Thames Crossing is a project which has gone up by a couple of billion. It's been delayed 2 years getting the mentioned this before, getting the application for the development consent order into the planning inspectorate. It's all sorts of problems it's had, and there is clearly strong political opposition to it. And she makes the point that it no longer, you know, this was a pre-Brexit scheme. It was all about, you know, getting Dover traffic through Kent and across the Thames into the north of England, and we don't need that sort of a crossing now of the Thames. I don't agree with her.
No,
but it does suggest that there is this strong, you know, within the Conservative Party's own backbenches. We're here with HS2, and we're hearing it with the Lower Thames Crossing. The local MP doesn't want it. Then it tells you something that it's the headwinds that this project is facing.
Yeah. What are Jackie Doyle Price's objections in a nutshell?
Broadly, it's going to add traffic in her constituency. The local roads are going to be chocker. It's funneling all of, you know, Kent's nasty lorries onto her nice streets.
Right. Okay. Well, that's understandable. And of course, her constituents are going to be concerned about something like that. But of course, you know, we talked about it. We're always talking about Lower Thames Crossing as well as other major road projects. And of course, this was one of the big infrastructure projects which was refused its development consent order, wasn't it, by the Department of Transport originally?
No, what happened was that the National Highways, or Highways England as it was then, submitted their preliminary paperwork to the planning inspector 2 years ago. Was it October, September, autumn anyway, 2020? The planning inspector looked at it and said, well, this won't do. You haven't done the right consultation. You basically haven't done enough paperwork yet. You've got to do more work on this. And I think there was an assumption, certainly from my part, that it wouldn't take very long to do whatever it was they hadn't done in the previous several years. And they would get the application, you know, all correct and back in. But it actually took them 2 more years. So they hadn't submitted the planning application. They hadn't had the planning application turned down.
Right, okay.
The way it's odd, the planning inspector, if something is designated as a nationally significant project, and I don't know what the definition of that, presumably it's sort of what it says it is, but someone somewhere must decide what is nationally significant. And this was deemed to be, Lower Thames Crossing is deemed to be nationally significant. Mm-hmm. It cannot go through the normal planning process. In the old days, it probably go for a public inquiry, and that was deemed to be too slow. So now it goes to the planning inspectorate for a development consent order. And what happens is you submit your application, and the first thing that the planning inspector does, it looks at it, and it spends about a month going, are we going to accept this? Will we even look at this? or will we not? And what happened this week, I think, or last week, is that the planning inspectorate, I beg your pardon, this week, the planning inspectorate said, yep, we like what you've done, National Highways. You've done your paperwork. We're not saying we approve the scheme, but we accept your application. We will take it to the next stage, and we will start our investigation, our panel of inquiry, or whatever the jargon is. We'll consider it. Was 2 years ago, they wouldn't even, you know, let them through the door.
Right. Okay. So a small step forward, I suppose, for National Highways on that. But of course, they've got a little bit of opposition to overcome as well.
Rather a lot. But we'll see. I mean, we've got... thing is, between now and... I mean, they still hope that, I think, that is it 2025, 2024? I've got it somewhere. They're still hoping to start construction in the... 2024, they're hoping they might be able to start construction. Mm. And they're in... I think they're in the stage of competitive dialogue with the bidders for the various... divvied up into three contracts.
Yes.
One for the actual tunnel itself, which is a major, it's going to be 4.3 kilometres long, but the longest road tunnel in the UK, and at 16 metres diameter, be the widest tunnel in Europe. So this is a substantial piece of infrastructure. But on top of that, you've got I'm mixing my units unforgivably here. 4.3 kilometres of tunnel and 14.3 miles, what's that, roughly 20 miles of new mm-hmm. roads, in sorry, 20 kilometres of
20 new, kilometers, yeah.
new roads either side in Kent and in Essex to link it into the motorways and the trunk roads on
right.
either side of the Thames. So there's there's three fairly hefty construction contracts there.
Yeah, plenty of work for somebody.
If it happens.
Yeah.
Of course, another thing that people don't like in their backyard is nuclear power stations. And, of course, that's another topic, another big infrastructure job that's very much in the news at the moment, Phil. Do you want to, we're going to talk about that one?
Sizewell C, yes. Well,
Sizewell C, yes.
The Chancellor Jeremy Hunt mentioned in his autumn statement a couple of weeks ago that this was going to be moving forward. This is the next big after Hinkley, Sizewell C. One of the, I would say, the two big spanners in the work. Three, if you include the fact that the local people don't want it on the whole, but national interest mm-hmm. in all of that. Sorry, Suffolk. But the two big googlers. One is that, how are we going to pay for it? And it was felt at the time that when the deal with between the government and EDF for Hinkley Point C, which is under construction, it was felt that the government had been far too generous to EDF. They'd given them. We'll come on to how the things are funded in a sec.
Yeah.
But there was a fear that on that basis couldn't afford to do Sizewell C. That was one spanner in the works, and the other growing spanner in the works, which perhaps also like to talk to a bit, is the involvement of the Chinese government in our nuclear yes. power industry. Yes. Now, let's talk first about the funding. Hinkley Point C, the one that's under construction there, that's being funded by the old model. It's called Contract for Difference. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm very conscious that some of our listeners are going to be going, what the hell is he talking about? This is all too complicated and boring. And the other people, other part of our listenership.
It is complicated.
Other part of our listenership were going, well, Bishop's got that wrong. He doesn't know what he's talking about. I don't know absolutely. I'm trying to phrase it in simple terms that I understand, and I hope it's accurate. I believe it to be accurate. But essentially, mm-hmm. Hinkley Point is being funded by EDF, has been told that you will be able to charge bill payers in the future, X pence per kilowatt hour, and I think it's 92p I've got in mind.
Yeah.
Mind as a number, which was something like 30% above what anyone else is allowed to charge for electricity. So it's a hugely generous price that they're going to be allowed to charge for electricity. And at some point in the future, when this thing is up and running, they will be able to get money back from electricity bill payers to pay for this big investment that mm-hmm. they've made over the past several years.
Yeah, because they have to fund it up front, don't they?
Yes, yes.
They're not getting any money from anybody else up front. They've got to pay for it, and then they'll get their money back.
That's my understanding. And obviously, it's not coming out of EDF's back pocket. It's in the markets and lenders and notes and all sorts mm-hmm. of other things, which I don't understand. But essentially, yes, they pay for it and they get the money later. And they've got to borrow that money. And the cost of borrowing that money is terribly expensive. And as interest go up, the cost of borrowing that money go up more. And so it becomes deferred payment becomes an expensive way of doing it. So what the government have agreed will happen for Sizewell C, the next one in Suffolk, mm-hmm. Is that they will be allowed to use a funding model called regulated asset base, which is the same model that's being used, for example, for the Thames Tideway Tunnel, super sewer. Mm. If you're a Thames Water bill payer, you're currently already paying £20 to £25 a year on your bill for the pleasure and privilege of this big super sewer being under construction. So you're not yet getting the benefit of it, but you will in the future. So Thames Water, well, it's been done through a separate vehicle called Thames Tideway or Basil Jet Holdings or whatever it's called, sort of a financial vehicle set up to deliver this project. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But the Thames Tunnel is already being paid for by customers while construction is going on. And that will be the model that EDF will be able to use for Hinkley Point C. Mm-hmm. More than that, the other big news yesterday is the government have said they're going to stump up the best part of £700 million, I think it's about £679 million, it is, to take a 50% share in the development of the project. So EDF will pay the same. So EDF, which is a French company, will be in bed with the UK government. And the Chinese, who are junior partners in Hinkley, will not be involved in Sizewell. They're pushed out of the scene. And having the government involved will improve the borrowing power. It'll be able to borrow more cheaply for the project. The fact that the bill payers will be paying from day one of construction means that there's less borrowing into the future required. And they reckon that over the lifetime of the power station, this funding model will save 30 billion quid. There's also a suggestion that there will be savings, we don't know exactly how much, that because Sizewell C is a duplicate of Hinkley Point C, as I understand it, certainly the same
type of reactor.
I don't know how much of the actual construction, because of the geology and so forth, will be identical. But the duplication of the reactor, they're supposed to be, or they're expected to be, fairly substantial savings there as well. So that's quite useful.
I mean, I have to say, I've always struggled to get my head around how these, you know, sort of strike price contracts, this contract for difference that EDF has for Hinkley Point, quite how that works, because correct me if I'm wrong, if you can correct me, that EDF has got a fixed price that they can charge. But we don't know what the market price for energy will be when this finally happens. So, I mean, how do we know that they're actually going to be charging more or less than people are paying other people for their energy? I mean, energy costs are going up.
You're absolutely right. It was reckoned that when that 90 whatever it is pence strike price was agreed, that the government had been far too generous, and that we were being ripped off. The British taxpayer bill payers were being ripped off, and it's far too generous. It doesn't seem so unreasonable now.
No, it doesn't.
And it will, if prices continue to go up, EDF. But the flip side of that is we have to let EDF. I say we the British nation, we have to let EDF make a profit on this. It's taking the risk, it's doing the work, it's only reasonable. If EDF goes bust during the construction of this project, if it walks away and says, sod it, we're not interested anymore, we'll be knackered. We need that energy to come on stream successfully. And whether that will come on stream on time is also, I gather, not entirely certain.
No. I think with these big projects, very, very little of that sort is certain, especially this far in advance. But I do think that the regulated asset base just sounds to me a far more logical and acceptable sort of way of funding a project like this, because you're making a down payment on the asset, and you're paying more in your electricity bills right now and not really getting the benefit of it. But when it happens, of course, you're not lumbered with a great big bill. Your costs aren't going to suddenly rocket up, and you'll be paying, sort of twice as much for your electricity because you have to pay EDF back for all the investment that they've put into Sizewell C. It seems much better to me. And also, I think it's more connected with the real world, because this is happening now during the construction process. So the funding is sort of contemporaneous with the construction, if you like, and they surely it's easier then to make a comparison and to judge whether or not the money coming in is enough to fund the work that you're doing. Do you think that's right?
Yes, it's a valid point of view. There's another point of view that it would be cheaper still if the utilities were nationalised and the government just paid for everything from direct taxation. And did it that way. That would be cheaper. The downside of that is the risk would not be sitting where the risk needs to sit, which is people who know what they're doing. governments are pretty rubbish at most things that governments do. Much better to have power companies building things or building power installations than governments.
Hmm. Yes, well, that makes sense. But I think that's probably a positive development as far as nuclear power is concerned. I mean, anybody who was worried about, because I mean, there were some very vocal calls, probably still are, to scrap Sizewell C. A lot of people were saying that we shouldn't be building more nuclear power stations. We should be putting this money into developing our renewable energy infrastructure instead.
But I think the consensus is increasingly it's not either or. It's everything. Now that we haven't got the Russian gas, and we're not allowed to use oil because it'll have cans of soup thrown over our paintings. we need nuclear, and we need wind, and anything else we can get our hands on.
Yeah.
What does concern me about Sizewell, there are technical issues which I'm not entirely au fait with, but to do with the groundwater, and the geological surveys are not entirely, benign. There are issues that have yet to be resolved from an environmental point of view relating to the water, I have read.
Right.
So I don't know how they're going to address that one.
I'm sure they'll find a way. But that, I suppose that's the big variable, isn't it? As you said earlier, the geology in Suffolk is likely to be quite different from the geology in Somerset. And so below ground, the design might be completely different. And the challenge is completely different as well from the construction point of view. The above ground stuff might be the same or similar, but you've got to take into account all the things which are different.
I mentioned a moment ago about the role of the Chinese government in all of this and in more widely in our infrastructure. And I think that's a fascinating thing. Broadly, it was George Osborne and David Cameron in the early days of the coalition. They were having found the note left by the former Labour Treasury Minister in the Treasury. George Osborne realised there was no money and thought, I know, the Chinese got loads of money. Let's go make friends with them. And he did. And I don't even remember pictures of David Cameron and President Hu then, I think, of China, having a pint of beer.
Before Xi, was it?
That's the one. drinking beer in an English pub somewhere and this, that and the other. And really push the boat out to and get the, invite the Chinese money over here. And I think it's Manchester Airport. Is that Chinese owned? It's certainly got Chinese involvement development in the northwest around Manchester.
Yeah,
and there's been a lot of Chinese funded development, as it has all over the world. But now there's a backlash, and it's a bit like cancel culture. That in the same way that certain popular children's author is no longer the nation's heroine that she once was in many people's minds. Suddenly, we can't have Chinese government involved in our infrastructure either.
Well, I think that backlash came perhaps rather late, because I can remember George Osborne going over to Beijing and cozying up to the Chinese Communist Party. And I think that was probably about the time when I became aware that China was going to be building Hinkley Point C. And I mean, I know bugger all about geopolitics, but I did think that sounded a bit off at the time, that we shouldn't really be involving the Chinese Communist Party so deeply in our national infrastructure, simply because they're cash rich and that we were a bit hard up at the time. And I think it's astonishing when I think back, there's only, 10 or 12 years that was happening, and things have completely turned around. As you say, look at Huawei. I had a Huawei mobile phone, I think, at one point, and they were cheap and they were good and they were very good at promoting themselves, and all of a sudden
cancelled
because like every other Chinese corporation, they have some sort of constitutional responsibility to answer any questions that Xi Jinping might ask them, and to divulge any information that they might have gathered from their Western clients. And of course, this is a step too far for most people. And that's why Huawei, which was tipped to roll out our 5G network, were shown the door. And I think probably wisely so. And so I think it's also a good thing that what's the organization called? China General Nuclear. Has, you know, sort of been shown the door when it comes to Sizewell C as well. Obviously, they're still involved with Hinkley Point, but it's we're well into that, so you can't just kick them out. Yeah, interesting the way attitudes have changed so much.
Well, when the door was open to Chinese money, I was kind of supportive at the time. Maybe not for, you know, nuclear and security things, but in general terms, because there's a thing about wherever there's a McDonald's, America doesn't go to war with or something. And the whole you know, Coca-Colaization of culture, that if we can get the Chinese, you know, driving smart cars, drinking Coca-Cola, eating McDonald's, wearing denim jeans and listening to Bruce Springsteen and Madonna, then they'll become just like us. Yeah. And communism will fall. And I kind of sort of bought into that. We should, you know, embrace them, yeah, rather than isolate them, because we've isolated North Korea all these years, and they remain an isolated oddball.
Yes.
Am I allowed to say, are we allowed to talk about countries as oddballs? I think we can when it's North Korea, can't we?
Yeah, I think when it's North Korea, can.
We can't say it about the French or the Welsh or the Scottish, but we can say it about North Korea. North Korea, you know, remains a slightly abnormal.
Yeah, because it's isolated.
Because of its isolation. And China, the hope was, and I went there several times in the, you know, between 95 and 2005, I probably went to China half a dozen times. And it was changing rapidly, and you could see it becoming, you know, certainly the big cities becoming, you know, more familiar looking, and it became a less strange place. And that seemed to me good for world peace, global geopolitics, and so on and so forth. And I've revised that. I'm now on the side of cancel China.
Yeah, well, I think one of the problems is that Western leaders and commentators were pretty naive about Chinese culture and the way the Chinese government rules the country. Because essentially what the Communist Party did was strike a deal with after Tiananmen Square. I mean, this is my understanding of it, and I might be entirely wrong, but it seems that after Tiananmen Square, when they realized that there was a sort of a groundswell of opinion amongst the population, and that they wanted more freedom. But I think what the government said to them was, look, you can't have more freedom, but you can have more money. So they sort of they liberalized their economy, and people started to feel better off, and they had access to the Western goods that they'd been deprived previously. They had a better lifestyle. And as long as they didn't rock the boat and didn't criticize the government, then they could continue to enjoy these material benefits. And it's sort of, you know, bread and circuses, isn't it? You give the people, you know, the nice sort of bright lights and the coloured beads, and they'll be compliant. And I think we see in China now, especially in the last couple of weeks, that that works up to a point, but only up to a point. And when people start to get used to having the material benefits that they've been plied with, they realize that they're still lacking something, and that's freedom. And I think that is the problem. So, yes, China did look as if it was becoming more like a Western economy, but its society was still very much Chinese and hasn't really changed at all. And I think that a lot of people in the West didn't realize that, didn't understand it. And it's only since, for example, when we've seen the behavior of the Chinese government in Hong Kong and the threats to Taiwan and the treatment of the Uyghurs in the west of the country, we started to realize actually these people aren't becoming more like us. You know, they might look a bit more like us, but their values are still very different.
But on this topic, though, I think it's as well to be sufficiently self-aware to recognize one's own hypocrisy. And I give an example. In the news as you're alluding to, the past few days, there have been demonstrations and protests, people holding up blank white sheets of paper, protests about COVID restrictions and strict lockdowns going on in China. And my gut when I read about these protests in China is you know, much the same as Tiananmen Square. Yay, go protesters, I'm on your side, stick it to the, you know, the big bad communist dictator. And then I think, well, hang on a minute, when we had anti-lockdown protesters in this country, I was thinking, shut up, you nutters.
Yeah. Oh, our lockdowns weren't quite as locked down as theirs.
I know, but our lockdown protesters, I think, are a little bit bats, and their lockdown protesters, I think, are somewhat heroic. That's pure double standards on my part, and which I cannot justify.
Yes, you're right.
But I think a lot of it, if I'm feeling that, I think a lot of us are feeling it.
Yeah, I think you're right. I certainly do as well. Again, it's the way these things are spun, and I suppose your prejudices coming out, not just yours, but our prejudices coming out, something like that. You see people being oppressed, but I mean, you know, like people being oppressed in this country, we think, well, you know, thank God for our policemen, you know.
Bringing it back to the World Cup, an interesting point. En passant, someone said that it is appalling that the World Cup is being held in a country where homosexuality is illegal, again, just like it was in 1966.
Mm-hmm. Of course. Yes. Yes, indeed. But again, if you're going to talk about double standards and hypocrisy, there we are criticising, and a lot of people have been very vocal about it, wearing the armbands and all the rest of it, and about Qatar and its treatment of the LGBTQ community. And yet, 4 years ago, we had another World Cup. And guess where that was? That was in Russia. Even I know that. And Russia isn't the most liberal place when it comes to LGBTQ tolerance. And it's not a country which is any more amenable to free speech than Qatar is. And yet I don't remember the same fuss being made about Russia back then. It probably would be now. But
it's easier to find a pint of beer in Russia, though.
Yeah, yes, that is true. Let's get back to construction. Anything else piqued your curiosity this week?
Just an and finally, really. Ran a piece on Tuesday this week, yesterday as we speak, that the Chartered Institute of Building have appointed another vice president who is going to be in line to take over of president of the CIOB. His name is, and I don't even know how to pronounce it, Mike Kagioglu? Kagioglu? K-A-G-I-O-G-L-O-U.
I don't know.
But anyway, he's Australian guy. He's a professor of Dean of Engineering, Design and Built Environment at Western Sydney University. He's Pro-Vice Chancellor of Global Development there. And that just struck me as interesting, because I thought, CIOB, oh, they've obviously got, you know, international expansionist, I would say ambitions. They've got lots of overseas members, just like, you know, REBA, the architects people have, the Institution of Civil Engineers have. They make a lot of money from their, you know, selling their qualifications overseas and so on. And it's, again, soft power and all of that. But it made me think, what sort of person becomes president of the Chartered Institute of Building? Well, this Australian professor guy is going to be the president of the Chartered Institute of Building in 2024. And he will take over from the person who takes over next year is Sandy Rees-Jones, who's a name that you and I are familiar with. She's been involved in she's not a builder. She's worked in and around the construction industry for a long time, but in sort of consultancy, marketing, public affairs kinds of roles. Yeah. Very prominent in all sorts of progressive causes in the industry. And I think she, you know, has an expertise which will do a lot of benefit to the CIOB, but she's not what you call a builder. And then the current president is a property developer. The one before that was a civil servant in the Department of Education. And you've got to go back to 2020, when Mark Beard was the president of the CIB. Mark Beard, one of the Beard family who own Beard Construction, one of our
prominent
regional contractors. And I mean, for all I know, he might have an accountancy qualification, but I think of him as a builder. I think, yeah, okay, you're boss of a building firm. That makes you a builder.
That's the business. That's his business. Yeah, yeah.
But then if you look back, I had a trawl back, and I went back to 2006 at past presidents. And there aren't that many people that I would actually call builders. There are professors, quite a few professors, surveyors who maybe worked in building management, so maybe they count moot. Mm-hmm. And a guy from Network Rail. In 2007, an architect, they've had only the second time they've had an architect as president of the CIOB. And I suppose it must be difficult for the CIOB to find an actual builder. Because builders don't have spare time.
Too busy building.
See, academics and consultants and civil servants, they've got spare time.
We assume. I mean, does it matter? Does it matter that the president of the CIOB isn't actually a builder?
I think it does.
What's their role? What do you expect them to do? What do you expect them to do?
I think they should lead and drive the agenda, be a figurehead, speak out on issues relating to the building industry. I think they should represent the building industry, whatever that is, I suppose. Yeah. If we talk about the building industry, the building trade. I mean, I don't expect them to be, specifying or counting bricks particularly, but...
No.
Yeah. What is the CIOB for, I suppose, is the question.
Yeah. I mean, I think somebody like Sandy Rees-Jones, who I'm sure has never laid a brick in her life, I can understand her doing the role because she's an expert in marketing and public affairs, and as a figurehead, that sort of background I'm sure is pretty useful. Somebody like, what did you say, Mike Cagliolo is a professor of? Something construction related, but he's
engineering, design, and built environment. So it's building professor.
Yeah, I don't know. I think literally, maybe too academic. He hasn't obviously somebody like Mark Beard, whose day to day business involves building things, can speak from the heart. He can speak from experience that this is what builders want. This is what builders represent, and he can embody that. Somebody like Mike Cagliolo can't really do that. He can speak only from an academic sort of hypothetical point of view, I suppose. I'm not sure whether or not that's true, or even if it is true, whether it matters. But I can see your point that maybe the president of the CIOB should be a builder because, then he can do what it says on the tin, as it were. But maybe they just want a diverse pool of people to choose from. As you say, I mean, you very helpfully sent me a list of the last, I think it's last nine, no more than that, dozen or so people. And Mark Beard stands out. And then 2015, Chris Chivers, who is also a builder, originally with John Lelliott Construction.
I've looked back further since I sent you that list. 2010 was James Waits, is a familiar name. In 2011, Alan Crane, who was a very familiar name. I don't know whether younger listeners will be familiar with Alan Crane, but he was a big name in
very prominent
in the industry and all sorts of things. And these are the sort of people you expect to be president of the top professional bodies, these sort of big industry names. Yeah. And I can understand academics taking a turn as president of a professional body because essentially the role of the CIOB is, as a chartered institution, is to do with standards, not of buildings, but of builders, of professional capabilities, of qualifications. So you create this qualification and you have bodies which can teach it, can award the qualification, that certify it, that audit the process, that vet that people who apply to the body reach the standard that the body expects you to reach. And that goes hand in hand with academia, with colleges and universities. So I can see absolutely that, and the Institution of Civil Engineers, I know, has had its fair share of academics, of professors, of presidents there. But even they have been prominent civil engineers.
Mm.
But it's, I think it's hard to be a builder and an academic at the same time.
Yes. Yes, I'd agree with that. I mean, my this is probably irrelevant, but I wonder if Mike Cagliolio, who's a professor at Western Sydney University, is he going to give up his job in still be in Sydney, is he?
I'm sure he'll be travelling. Well, he's not the first overseas one. I mean, the current president of CIOB is Malaysian. In 2014, they had a Lebanese professor from the Gulf University for Science and Technology. 2009 was their first overseas president, was a Chinese professor, Li Xirong, who was the first woman and the first overseas. So they've now had four overseas people, and five if you include Chris Soff, who's Gleeds America boss. He's British, but I think at the time was working in America and he spent a lot of his career in America.
Right.
So he's sort of, half and half, I suppose, put in both camps. But certainly, four overseas presidents. But I suspect that's where as an organisation, that's probably where their growth will be coming from.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we've talked in the past quite a lot about working from home and remote working. And I suppose if you're in Sydney and you're the boss of the CIOB in the UK, that's probably the ultimate in working from home.
Well, no, they're not. The president is a one-year figurehead role. I mean, yes, you're involved in the committees and you're working and so on. The boss of the CIOB is the chief executive, Caroline Gumbel, who comes from a... I think she's got a HR background originally, but has worked for other trade associations. I think she worked for Make UK, the manufacturing organisation, before she joined the CIOB 2 or 3 years ago. So it's valid to have your chief executive, I don't mean this pejoratively, but a functionary, an officer who will do the job, who will, make things work. Whereas the president is an honorary role, it's a figurehead role. I mean, yes, there's work involved, but it's I just feel it should be someone who says you're the top person in the industry this year, where you're gonna look up to you and you're gonna open the doors and promote the interests of I was gonna say promote the interests of the industry, but that's what a trade association does. So maybe I'm confusing trade associations with professional bodies. Maybe professional bodies don't need build. Maybe the CIOB doesn't need a builder. Federation of Master Builders, National Federation of Builders, they need a builder.
Yes.
Maybe the CIOB doesn't.
Possibly.
But can you imagine REBA, the Royal Institute of British Architects, picking someone who wasn't an architect? I mean, that would be unthinkable.
No. Certainly not a builder.
We haven't actually mentioned, it's quite interesting that it's a couple of months ago now that he took up post, a chap called Oki, Muyiwa Oki, who works for Mace, and he's only 31, he's born in Nigeria, so he's the first black president of REBA, he's the youngest black president of REBA, or RIBA, as some people call it, I call it REBA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there was... I gather from a couple of articles I've read, quite a groundswell of movement to kind of get a different type of person. They didn't want a greybeard anymore. They wanted someone to stir the pot, some bright young thing who's, represent the normal architect. He's not some architectural whiz in the sense that he's designed some famous building and is a star of the design.
No, he's not Rogers or...
He may become that, but it's not why he's got the job. He's not got the job because he's the best architect. He's seen to be someone who's going to move and shake things up a bit.
Yeah. And actually, he works for Mace, which isn't...
Correct.
He works in architectural practice.
Which is unusual. That's another unusual thing about it. I'm sure they would present Mace as a consultancy rather than a contractor in this context.
Yeah. I always get the feeling that Mace can be whatever it wants to. It's sort of a rather amorphous sort of organisation. Sometimes it's a contractor, sometimes it's a consultant, sometimes it's a designer.
It's called self-identifying, David. It's the modern way.
Yes, yeah, indeed. Indeed, that's the way to go.
Oh, final point that we haven't talked about, could have done, but I will point anyone who's got an interest in this to report on our website at theconstructionindex.co.uk. There is a new organisation, trade body, federation in the industry, which goes frankly useless name, I think, of Plant Sector Representative Organisation. Can you imagine what Sector Representative Organisation is?
I used to think it was the Construction Plant Hire Association.
Well, the Construction Plant Hire Association is, while it represents a goodly swathe of people who own and operate construction plant, there are still contractors who operate plant, because before it was Construction Plant Hire Association, it was a Contractors Plant Association.
Right.
But then everything moved to hire. But there are, for example, the demolition contractors. You've got the Scottish Plant Owners Association, particularly the Civil Engineering Contractors Association. These organisations have got very strong interest in how plant is used and the standards of it.
Yeah.
Anyway, this new organisation has come about. It's a spin-off from the changing role of the CITB, the chaos that all the card schemes have found themselves in, suddenly CPCS has no more authority than other card schemes because it's not CITB, and it was all big chaos, and standards weren't getting written, whatever. And CPA, the Plant Hire Association, in 2019 got the ball rolling by pulling together all the other associations with an interest in plant, saying, look, there's a vacuum here that we're prepared to fill, but we don't really have the authority to do it on our own. Will you come and, you know, can we make this new organisation which represents everyone? And then we can say that this is the, you know, when it comes to setting the standards for what should a banksman, what should an excavator operator, what should a whatever be expected to know, do, have done, and so on, that we can say this is what we require. And therefore this new organisation has emerged. It's sort of existed for a couple of years, but it's only gradually sort of forming, bits, you know, another committee being added and so on. And today was the day basically when they said, we're here, even though they've been here. Right. They've been here for a couple of days. I said, why are you sending this now? What's the news peg? What's actually happened this week? And said, this week we decided to tell the media that we existed. So it's not a very strong news peg.
No, that's true. PSRO isn't exactly snappy, is it? So they might need to think of something else.
It is a rubbish name, and very unfashionably, the same person is both chair and chief executive. Kevin Minchin, who's the chief executive of the Construction Plant Hire Association, is both chair and chief exec. I don't think that will last for long. I think they need to sort of sort out who's going to devote time for it. Mm. How active an organisation it becomes in other issues relating to plant will be interesting to see. I suppose it depends whether it gets its own chief executive aside from Mr. Minchin. If he does get his own chief executive, will it become an alternative to the Construction Plant Hire Association as a voice for the plant industry? Or will it be the voice for the plant industry in lobbying? Things like Red Diesel, for example.
Mm. Well,
clearly the construction industry lost its lobbying on that. We mentioned the other week. I'm talking too much. I'm going to shut up. Anyway, psro.org.uk. You can find out more about that.
All right. So are we done? Should we let people get on with their lives now?
Right, well, okay, let's call it a day. Let's go do something less interesting, David. It is, it's December tomorrow, and we've only got one more episode before Christmas. Do you know that, David? We're just going to do one more episode before Christmas. And then we'll be back in the new year. So are we going to do our review of the year next week? Should we look back and highs and lows of 2022?
Yeah, we could do that.
I'll have to get my thinking cap on. Right. Thank you, everyone, once again for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast of the Construction Index. For another week, that's all we've got. But I've been Phil Bishop and he's been David Taylor. So thank you very much and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.